The Seder is one of the most significant events on the Jewish calendar, as everybody is aware. I just want to mention before we begin, it's always important to review basic ideas and to try and gain a deeper understanding of what the Seder is all about. But I think that this year, the Seder will take on added significance in light of the events that we're experiencing. And you'll see, as we study the Torah and as we apply it to the events in our own lives, it gives us an additional, you know, awareness, appreciation of the eternal truth of Torah. First of all, it's significant because the entire concept of freedom has become very important in the world. Ever since 9/11 and the war that we're fighting right now has been described, certainly by the representatives of the United States, the so-called free world, that this is really a battle, not just a battle against civilization, but a battle for freedom. And that the way our own leaders understand the situation is that the enemy has been determined to destroy freedom. And there's a lot of truth in that. We value our way of life because we're not oppressed, so to speak, and we have the great gift of freedom. So that's something which is significant, but I think it's therefore important to recognize that we appreciate this kind of freedom, no question about it. But to be able to differentiate the Jewish idea of freedom, the idea of freedom that the Torah is talking about and that we are involved with in the Seder is not exactly the same. And because of what's going on, it should cause us to attain deeper understanding and an appreciation. There's another reason why the Seder will take on tremendous significance this year, and that's because of the terrible plight that we find ourselves in today. I don't know if anybody saw the Jewish Week this past week, which is a major article describing the fact that the war that's being waged today is not just against Israel, it's primarily against Israel, but that the Islamic terrorists have declared war on Jews across the world. It's a very serious article, and some people are saying, and I happen to agree with them, that this is the worst situation in terms of anti-Semitism that we face since the Holocaust. And one can even draw an analogy. It's something that we have to take very, very seriously. It has to affect us in a certain way. I mean, I was discussing it this morning. The fact of the matter is that for the first time since the Holocaust, Jews, especially in Israel, find themselves in a situation where they've been targeted for destruction. In the Holocaust, it was the Nazi war machine. Here it's a war machine consisting of terrorist suicide bombers, and essentially they're basically defenseless. Because no matter what the government does, it's impossible to provide at this point the kind of protection. So you have Jews walking around every day and they're just targets. And the increase in the number of killings to the extent that in the last 4 or 5 days, we're talking about 30 people or so around that, is terrifying. So it's a wake-up. They're referring to it as a wake-up call. And as far as what can a person do, that's also very frustrating, because in a practical way there is not that much that we can do. We're not in control. But each Jew has a responsibility to be involved, to be concerned. And if there's anything a person can do practically, he certainly should. But I emphasize that it's a wake-up call, and we have to all become better Jews. We have to do tshuva, we have to repent, we have to be mispalel, we have to pray. In fact, I think at every gathering tonight, before we daven Maariv, we should say Tehillim. This is something that should affect the way in which we live. It's a wake-up call. I mean, you can't just go on with the life as usual. That's true when the world is in any kind of a calamity. The rabbis teach us from the flood, when Noah was aboard the ark, that there's inferences to the fact that he refrain from being involved in sexual relations with his wife. It doesn't say it explicitly, it's a midrash. Because the world is in a state of suffering. So even if it doesn't specifically affect the Jew, it's something that a person has to take to heart. But certainly when it affects the Jews, every one of us has to strive to become a better Jew. And to improve ourselves, to not to engage in Lashon Hara, to have an attitude of helpfulness to fellow Jews, and to realize this is a serious time, not to be involved in nonsense, but to restore ourselves to the life of Torah and mitzvot and tzedakah. And these are the time-honored things that will bring about a Yeshua. So the Seder this year is really about establishing Jewish identity. So I think it's going to be extremely, extremely important. And therefore we should all be prepared in the proper way. So I'd like to discuss certain general ideas about the significance of the Seder and the relationship that it has to freedom and to the establishment of a proper idea of Jewish identity. So I'd like to frame the Shia around certain questions, and I have to decide how many questions that I would choose to address. Anybody has any idea how many I come up with? Four questions. Well, I don't know why. Just figured four is a nice number. So I'd like to I'd like to frame the discussion around four significant questions. I'm sure you have more questions, and it's a good idea not to ask all your questions now. You want to save something for the Seder. That's very important. If you've done all the studying and asking and answering before the Seder, so what are you going to do with the Seder? So the four questions that I'd like to raise are, first of all, it seems to me that there's a certain ambivalence. The key theme of the Seder is freedom. And the basic idea that we're expressing is that when God took the Jews out of Egypt, it was not just a historical event, that there was a people that was oppressed, and God saved them, and now they're free. But there's something more than that, that God gave us something which is eternal, eternally free. And that's what we say. That's what we say in the Haggadah. We say that we praise God who redeemed our fathers and who redeemed us. So the idea that the Jews were permanently redeemed and that therefore the Jews are in a state of freedom seems to be part of the Seder. But at the same time, there are other statements that would seem to contradict us. By the way, this idea of eternal freedom we say in the Maariv. We'll be saying in the Maariv service. We say it every night. When we refer to the Exodus, we praise God who struck with his anger all the firstborn of Egypt and removed his nation Israel from their midst to eternal freedom. So on the one hand, we're proclaiming that we're eternally free. On the other hand, it would seem, if you take a look at the Haggadah, that that's not the case. Because there's a little paragraph in the Haggadah which is called Holach Ma'anya. This is the bread of affliction. You're all familiar with this, which our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. And then we say, whoever is hungry, let him come and eat. Whoever requires, whoever is in need, let him come and join us for the Passover sacrifice. Then we say, now we are here, and the next year may we be in the land of Israel. But the concluding statement is, Hashata Avdei. Now we are slaves. Lashana Abav and Echorin. And we're praying that next year we'll be free. So isn't this a contradiction? Because we're saying that we're really slaves. So we can't have it both ways. Are we in a state of freedom? Because God gave us freedom and it's an eternal freedom. This would seem to contradict, you know, Jewish history, that sometimes the Jews are free, sometimes the Jews were not free. But the Haggadah is saying that we're eternally free, but it's also saying that now we're slaves. So that's one of the ambivalences. Can anybody think of another statement in the prayers that indicates the idea that we're not in a state of freedom? Just to complete the picture of these conflicting references. All right, I'll give you a hint. It's in the Shemona Esrei. It's in the middle blessings. Taka, b'shofar gadol, l'chei ruseinu. So we're praying, that's really for our freedom, that the sound of the shofar, which is associated with the Mashiach. So, of course, we're praying that the day will come when our freedom, we will achieve our freedom. So if that's the case, then we're not in a state of freedom. So it seems to me that that's an ambivalence. It also seems to me that this is a pretty good approach to having a Seder, to try and notice these types of contradictions, because that's what gets people thinking. That's the derech, so to speak. That's the Jewish way of approaching learning. That's one of my questions. Okay, I also would like to explain certain things which, at least on the surface, seem difficult. This is something you're all familiar with, that towards the latter part of the first section, before you get into the eating of matzah and Pesach matzah maror, so Rabbi Gamliel said, whoever did not say these three things did not fulfill his obligation. And these are Pesach, Matzah, and Morah. So you're all familiar with that. Then you uncover the Pesach we don't really have today. That's the Paschal. We just have a piece of meat, the bone, shank bone. And you explain each one. Then you uncover the Matzah, and you explain the Matzah, and then you uncover the Morah. What is he talking about? Whoever did not say these three things did not fulfill his obligation. What do you mean? What obligation is he talking about? What obligation? Is he talking about the obligation of eating these three things? That's very difficult because we don't even eat the Pesach today. We eat the Afikoman. The Afikoman, by the way, is a remembrance of the Pesach, but it's not the Pesach. Besides the mitzvah of eating the matzah, you fulfill later. Afterwards, you wash your hands and you say the blessing and you eat the matzah. So what is the meaning of that statement? That's my second question. The third question is, we say some strange things. You have to pay attention to what you're saying when you recite the Haggadah. If you do, you'll discover a world of ideas, tremendous ideas. Right before the Hallel, which we recite in the first portion of the Haggadah, we make a very interesting statement. And I wonder if people realize what they're saying. In every generation, Chayav Adam Liros Es Atzmo, a person is obligated to view himself Ki'ilu Hu Yatza Mitzrayim, as though he or she, doesn't matter, has actually left Mitzrayim. As it says, V'higar Tal Avincha Bayom Hu Leimer, you shall tell your child on that day and say, Bavur Zeh, because of this, Asar Hashem Li, God did to me B'tzeisi Mitzrayim. So when you tell your child, you're telling your child, because of this, God did to me. It becomes very, very personal. The whole thing becomes very personal. And therefore, it's as though you're telling a story that happened to you. Now, that sounds very nice, but what is the significance of that? Well, what does it mean, a person is supposed to imagine? And it goes on to say, not lowest ever sustainable God, God, like HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that we shouldn't think that God redeemed just our fathers, but also us. God redeemed with them. So what is the meaning of that statement? I think a lot of people I've heard different explanations. It seems to me like people have trouble with that. You're supposed to envision it as though you were there in Egypt and you went through the experience and you left yourself. What is it saying? That we're supposed to play games to make up some kind of a fiction in our mind to actually imagine? Picture yourself. Is that what we're supposed to do? You're supposed to actually visualize, picture yourself, make up a little movie in your own head in which you are a slave in Egypt and doing all the work and getting beaten and this and that. Is that what it's telling us to do? It sounds absurd. So if that the question arises, what is the name? But this is an obligation. This is a mitzvah. It's brought down in the code. The Rambam mentions it, and it's a major portion of the Haggadah, because it leads right into, what does it lead into? Hallel, lefichach. Therefore, we have to give praise. So that, why do we have to give praise? Because you were taken out of Egypt. But the truth of the matter is that you weren't taken out of Egypt. So that's the third question. And the fourth question pertains to, again, an ambivalence. All my questions have to do with these types of ambivalences. It seems to me that there's an ambivalence with regard to the most essential mitzvah of the night. What would you say is the most essential mitzvah of the night? Well, there's two major mitzvahs, though. I hate to do this, major mitzvahs, minor mitzvahs, but the answer that Delaney is giving, that the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, everything revolves around that. Everything is incorporated into this retelling of the story. The truth of the matter is that in terms of the energy, in terms of preparation, the retelling of the story is really significant. But in terms of the performance of a mitzvah, the eating of the matzah is really the essential mitzvah, because the entire holiday is named Chag HaMatzos HaZeh. Chag HaMatzos. It derives its name after the object of matzah. So the object of matzah, the eating of matzah, is extremely, extremely important. What ambivalence do we find with regard to matzah? What is the ambivalence? The question I'm asking is the matzah eaten essentially because of the affliction, because of the enslavement? That aspect, and what you're saying is true.
Well, I think it was.
If you read the matzazu, the statement which explains why we eat the matzah, it gives exactly that reason. That it's really because of Geula. Geula is redemption. And that's what you you're all familiar with the idea that it came upon them so quickly that they had to leave in a hurry, and they didn't have time to wait for the bread to rise. So ugos matzos kilo chametz. So then it was baked very quickly, and it was matzah. So therefore, the matzah is quintessentially an expression of geula, of redemption. Now the contradiction to that is what we said in Halach Manya. And this is the bread of affliction that our forefathers ate in the Egypt land, and that's exactly why we break it into pieces. Because that's the nature, the derech of a poor man. He can't afford to have a whole bread even, so it's broken into pieces. So therefore it seems to me that this is a very big problem, because it's a contradiction. Is it freedom or is it enslavement? So that is the fourth question. We said also that aside from the eating of the matzah, really the focus, the energy, is on the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. To recount the story of the Yetzias Mitzrayim, of the exodus from Egypt. This is a very interesting, a very unique kind of a mitzvah. Because this mitzvah really, properly speaking, cannot be done alone. Unlike most other mitzvahs. First and foremost, it involves children. Children are, as we've said many times, are really extremely important. It's a mitzvah to tell the story to a child. And preferably a child who really doesn't know the story. And he's hearing it for the first time. Of course, this is a question. Because generally speaking, the mitzvah is applied to adults when you're 13. And well, why should this particular mitzvah involve a child? The child is not obligated in mitzvahs. And it's appropriate to teach a child, even a child who's young, so that he's not even involved in chinuch, even in, you know, children when they get a little older, so they do the mitzvah as preparation. But here it's to a child. And then the Rambam says, if you don't have a child, so then you should try and find someone that doesn't know the story, to tell it over to somebody. That's why you're supposed to invite people. This is really the night of Kirov, so to speak, Kirov, the outreach. This is the outreach night, and you're supposed to really invite people. So it's, if you don't have your own child, the highest level is to teach it to your own child. If not, to teach it to somebody else's child, or anyone, any fellow Jew who needs to know the story. And of course, worst comes to worst, you tell the story to yourself. But truthfully speaking, it's very difficult to imagine a person fulfilling the mitzvah properly all by himself. That's one time of the year that you're not really supposed to be alone. And most people, you know, with their family. Of course, the question is, what is the reason for this? What is the significance of the child over here? I think that the answer has to do with the Halach Ma'anya. The Halach Ma'anya is very, very important. It's something which is very, it seems to be tangential, but it contains very, very significant ideas. That is, Halach Ma'anya, this is the bread of affliction. And I maintain that the essential idea of Sipur, to tell the story, is different than what we do on Purim. On Purim we also tell a story. We tell the story of what happened to the Jews. It's not that different on the surface. The Jews were marked for destruction, and then there was the intervention of Mordechai and Esther, then there was the miracles, and the Jews were saved. What would you say then is the difference between telling the story as we do in the Megillah about that event and the telling of the story of the Exodus? Two stories. What's the difference between the recitation of the two stories? There's a big difference. The telling of the story of the Megillah is recounting an event in history that we need to be familiar with. But the objective, the story of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, is really to establish the foundations of the Jewish people. It's not just to recount the historical event, what took place. And if a person merely does that and tells over the story like you would a historical event, you didn't fulfill your obligation. The real essence of the story is the foundations of the Jewish people, what the Jewish people really are. You have to understand what the Jewish people really are. And to establish on this night an identification, you actually, in a sense, become a member of the Jewish people, to establish your identity. And that is why the story you break, before you begin the story, you break the matzah, and you actually have to tell the story in the presence of the matzah, when the matzah and moror is in front of you. So therefore, getting back to the ambivalence I mentioned before, there are really two mottos. In my opinion, there are two mottos on that night. There is the matzah which is relevant to the seeper, to telling the story of the Exodus, and the matzah which is relevant to the story. Actually, it's the story of the enslavement. Of course, it leads to Exodus. It's really you're telling the story of the enslavement. So the matzah represents enslavement. And that is, that must be present at the time you actually begin to tell the story. You're telling the story over that matzah. Then there's the matzah of redemption. So the two matzos that I'm talking about, and of course I'm talking conceptually now, it's the same, physically it's the same thing, but conceptually it has two identities. The matzah, which is the bread of affliction, relates to the mitzvah of sipur, of telling the story. The matzah, which is geula, which is redemption, relates to the mitzvah of eating. When you eat the matzah, you're not eating the matzah, which is the bread of affliction. You're not eating that matzah. You're eating the matzah, which is the symbol, so to speak, of redemption. In order to understand this, I want to take up something which is really major. The entire theme of the Seder is the story of the enslavement. And then we have to understand what was the purpose of this enslavement. Why were the Jews enslaved in the first place? It wasn't just an accidental phenomenon, because God had told Avraham Avinu that you should know that your children will be enslaved in a nation which is not theirs, and then they'll be taken out, and I will with great wealth. But the question arises, what was the purpose of this enslavement? You have to understand that. And what did it achieve? The purpose of the enslavement was to establish the nation of Israel, a nation which is different, which is unique, which is unlike every other nation. And the only way you can appreciate this is to have a sense, to have a certain sense of nationalism, of what the essence of each nation is, and to recognize how different the Jewish people are. And I think that that's something which is not really appreciated, because every nation, what is a nation after all? There's different nations, and every nation has a certain type of a pride, a certain type of national pride. A nation really is something which represents a collective ego. And people get together and they're united by certain things, by certain accidental phenomena, and whether it's a culture, whether it's a land, whether it's a certain achievements, so then they have a certain identity. And they're very proud of their identity. It's an expression of a certain type of collective ego. The Jewish people is completely different. And you see that in the very manner in which the Jews were established. In order for the Jewish people is a creation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's a people that never would have come into existence by any type of a natural progression, by any type of natural phenomena. To the contrary, as I said, if every nation is an expression of collective ego, in order to establish the Jewish people, God put them into a state of slavery. They had to be put into a state of slavery. Because what does enslavement do? Enslavement crushes, it really destroys the ego. That is really the most ego-depleting experience that a person can possibly go through. When a person, and you might wonder, well, that's a terrible thing, because a person's confidence is broken down, and a person can't function properly unless he has a certain type of a self-confidence. But God deliberately wanted to do that, so that they would lose two things. They lose their independence, and they become a subservient type of a people. And that's the first thing, because most people have a desire to be independent and to be able to determine the course of their own existence. The second thing that God did by making them into a state of slavery, that's connected to it. One, it breaks your ego, but also it breaks the materialistic fantasy. Every group of people is involved in what they would call the pursuit of happiness. And that's really why people want to be free. Because when we're free, we can do whatever we want to do. And we're involved in the pursuit of happiness. And the pursuit of happiness always has to do with achieving some type of a materialistic situation, some type of a materialistic fantasy. And God deliberately put them in a situation where they lost any type of sense of independence because they were slaves to Paro. They had a master. And also, since they were slaves, they did not have the opportunity, the ability to engage in this pursuit of materialistic gratification. That is exactly the state that God wanted them to be in. In that situation, God sent Moshe to the Jewish people. And the message that Moshe brought to the Jewish people is very, very interesting. Moshe never told the Jews to rebel against the enslavement. He never organized any type of a resistance against the enslavement. He never spoke about the oppression. And also when he went to Paro, he didn't preach to him that it was wrong. He never spoke about the enslavement. All he asked for was that the Jews should be given an opportunity to leave and to worship God. That's all he asked for. And that strikes us as being very, very strange, because the way we would envision the situation would be where that's the whole essence, that the whole evil is that these people are enslaved and they don't have their freedom. Moshe never spoke about that. And there's a reason. What was the idea that Moshe sought to communicate to the Jewish people? Why didn't he talk to them about freedom? Why didn't he urge them to take measures, to fight against their oppressors, and so forth? The reason is because what he was trying to communicate to them was a completely different idea of freedom. That is to say that the true freedom of man really has nothing to do, has very little to do with the physical situation that a person is in. That is to say that if the Jews were removed from Egypt, if they were able to save them, to bring them out of Egypt, to extricate them from a situation of slavery, then the truth of the matter is that they would, from a metaphysical, from a spiritual point of view, they still would have been slaves. That's what he tried to teach them. That it doesn't really depend. Of course, the freedom is a necessary condition. The physical freedom is a necessary condition. But you've seen many, many cases in history where people were enslaved. And because of rebellion or because of other forces, they were able to break away from the physical restraints. But there's no transformation of the person. The person remains a slave. It doesn't really make that much difference. I know emotionally it's very hard to accept this because there's a certain pain. But if you think about it philosophically, there is not altogether that much difference than an individual who's in a state of a physical enslavement and most people who are not in a state of physical enslavement because they're not leading a free life. As long as a person is living in accordance with certain compulsions, whether they're external compulsions or whether they are internal compulsions, they don't have true freedom. And what Moshe Rabbeinu taught the Jewish people was that the true freedom for Adam, for the human being, it resides in a certain condition of the soul. If the soul is not free, if the soul is subservient to any kind of a master, so then that person doesn't have freedom because they're under a compulsion. And there are basically two types of master that the human being falls prey to. One is the human image. One is the physical master. That's why the Jews were removed from a state of independence and they became subservient to Paro. So part of the idea of freedom was to extricate them from subservience to the human master, to the human, to the mystique of the human leader. That the Jews were able to experience through the Makos, through the plagues that were brought down on Paro, and slowly but surely they became aware of the fact that this is just a fiction, that there is no such thing as a human power, that the only power resides in God. But you have to realize that there's one more thing. The true identity of the Jewish people and the true objective of the exodus from Egypt was not to take them out of a state of subservience. Not really, not to make them free, not to take them out of a state of slavery. The Jews were intended, I don't like to use the word slavery, they were intended to be avadim. We'll use the word eved. Eved is more of a servant than a slave. But the objective of this transformation was to transform them from being avadim, from being slaves or servants to Paro, and now they were going to become avadim to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They were not to be removed from a state of avdus. They were to remain avadim. But there's a huge difference in who the master is. And that's something which is very difficult for a person to accept. It's a very difficult idea. But according to Judaism, the only person who is really free is the person who is an eved. I like the Hebrew term better, because in English you have to say slave. So the word slave has negative connotations. And I don't want to say that we're a slave to God. So when I'm referring to God, I'm going to say that we should be servants of God. The only person who is free is a person who's a servant to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Any other situation cannot be a situation of freedom. And I'll tell you why. Because if you're not a servant to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then you're living your life in accordance with a certain compulsion, whether it be because of a fantasy, whether it be because of a desire, whether it be because of a societal phenomenon, whether it be because of certain images in the world, icons in the culture that you look up to. But it cannot be true freedom, because you're not living in accordance with your real nature, and your real nature is to live a life in accordance with the truth. That's an Eved Hashem. A person who serves God means to say that he's fulfilling his purpose, he's guiding all of his activities in accordance with the will of his Creator, with the will of God, who knows his true nature and who guides him to fulfilling that which he was created to do. That's a state of freedom. Freedom means that you're living your life in accordance with its true purpose. If you're not living your life in accordance with its true purpose, so then you're a slave. Every other being naturally fulfills its purpose. Every animal is living, it doesn't complain, it does what it's supposed to do, it's fulfilling its nature. Freedom means to fulfill your nature. You were designed for a certain purpose, you were given a nature that is in line, that's harmonious with that. If you're not living in line with your nature, then it's a wasted existence, it's an absurd existence. But Adam, man, is the only being who has the capacity, because God gave him the freedom to choose. So therefore he can fail to opt to utilize his power of Bechira, and when he does so, he's embarking on a course which is not in line with the nature that he was given. And he's living an existence which is not a human existence. It's an existence which would be appropriate for a different kind of a being, but not appropriate for a being that was endowed with a divine image, a Tzelem Elokim, which has the capacity to get closer to God through an appreciation of the wisdom of God. That is the path of fulfillment. That's the only path to freedom. Only a person who's living in that context, that for him the reality that dominates his existence is the reality of his relationship to God, that's the only freedom we know. That's the idea, Ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim, that the Jews are avadim unto me, they have to be my servants. That's why the Jews were the foundation of the Jewish people had to come about through a state of a loss of freedom, of a loss of independence, and to experience servitude, so that when they were removed from one state of servitude, and they were placed in a different state of servitude. To remove themselves from any type of bondage to an external master. As far as the other thing is concerned, as far as the other element, the pursuit, the fact is that people pursue all kinds of materialistic fantasies. They chase after them, and they use up benafsho yavi lachma, that a person destroys himself in the process of chasing after things that are purely in the imagination, which aren't real. That transformation that the Jews were willing to live in, no nation would have accepted the Torah. Because every nation imagines that it's free and it can have whatever it wants, and it looks at the Torah as being a limitation of freedom. People can't understand that the Torah is the gateway to freedom. The Jews, in order to be redeemed, had to be capable of going about through a certain type of a transformation. And that was essential. That transformation took place on a very, very special night. And now you'll realize also the importance of the night, that all the mitzvos of Pesach are performed at night, unlike other holidays when the mitzvos are performed during the day. Because the Jews left Egypt in the daytime, Mimacharas, on the day after the Pesach. But the night when the Jews achieved their freedom was the night when they brought the Karban Pesach. Even though they didn't leave till the next day, but the night on which they achieved their freedom was on that night. What was the freedom? How is it expressed? It was expressed in the fact that they engaged in an entirely new performance, in the performance of mitzvos. A new phenomenon had come into being, the divine command, which guides our lives, which teaches us to relate to the Creator through a different kind of a system of knowledge and a system of ideas, which pertains to every aspect of our lives. So on that night, they withdrew themselves from the idolatrous, the primitive idolatrous religions that all people were engaged in, and which they partook of as well, and they brought the Korban Pesach. And that's the whole idea of the sprinkling of the blood. And it's very strange the way it depicts it. It says that God says that I'll pass over the houses, and I will see the blood, and I will not allow you to be harmed, the ones who are inside. So I always ask this question. On which side of the door was the blood? Was the blood on the outside, or was the blood on the inside? The blood, it would appear when you read it superficially that the blood is on the outside, because it says that God will see the blood. But of course that's absurd, because God doesn't have to see, God knows. But it says, V'hoya adam lachem la'os, the blood will be for you as a sign. When it says that the blood will be for you as a sign, it means that the blood will be visible on the inside. And I will see the blood means, Rashi says, I will see that you are involved in mitzvahs. Now the meaning, of course, God knows. The meaning of the blood is that the Jew has to recognize that on that night they were differentiated. The idea of Pesach, of skipping over, means that God separated one people from another people. God differentiated between two different types of people. And the key element in the differentiation has to do with the fact that this is a community of people that are involved in an entirely different way of living their lives. And at the center of that is the very special relationship that they have to God, which no other people has. A relationship to God which is based upon a system of knowledge, of ideas, of yediyah. To know God through knowledge and understanding, and to incorporate that knowledge into your life, that is the phenomenon which differentiates. So now I'd like to answer about the ambivalence of the matzah. How can something be a sign of oppression, of enslavement, and a sign of geula? This is a very, very important idea. We were discussing it this afternoon in different contexts. And I can just begin. I can't go through all the sources and everything. But the Derech Hashem, the manner, to the extent that we can know the manner in which God relates to us, is God does not expect us to change overnight. And God deals with us on the level that we're on. And the system that God uses is to give us the ability to undergo a transformation. We can't just become perfect citizens overnight. There's a long process, and a person has to go through a transformation. So the first step is the enslavement, that God caused the Jews to be enslaved. Well, enslavement is not so bad, because when a person, a lot of people go through spiritual awakenings when they're in prison. Yeah, I'm sure you've read accounts of that, because as long as they were free, they were chasing after the craziness. Finally, they were in jail. They're taken away from any type of gratification. So then they have to use their mind. There's a very famous book and a movie. Most people over here, I guess, are too young for that. Don't remember. Very famous movie, which you should try and get that great movie, which depicts the life of an individual who was he was a murderer, and he was sentenced to life in prison. And in the prison, due to certain accidents, he had nothing to do with his time, but due to certain accidents, he became a great, great scientist, and he wrote books. Ever hear of Birdman of Alcatraz? Put that on your movie list. It's a good movie. It's fascinating. But, I mean, it depicts the idea that he turned into one of the great scientists of the time. And a totally different person. A person who was completely transformed from what he was before. Because he lost his freedom, and he had no choice. So he had to resort to the greatest resource that God has given us, the human mind. The human mind is where freedom is at. So therefore, the fact that God took away the freedom is not enough. There are many people that lose their freedom. But it's, for example, like Shabbos. The purpose of Shabbos. Many people observe Shabbos. in the sense that it's a great day. You can't be involved in your concerns, in your business, in your worries. Psychologically, it's a great day to have a Shabbos. You're free. But then, so at the beginning of Shabbos, certain people are kind of happy because you're getting away from the... Then, towards the end of the day, you're getting antsy already. Because the Shabbos can be a tremendous burden for many people. Like, because what do you do with... All right, now that you've rested up, what do you do with all this free time? See, the real purpose of Shabbos is not simply that you shouldn't be involved in work. The objective, though, of Shabbos is not just to refrain from work, but it's to redirect all of that energy. The energy that you're using in the physical world for business and to create the physical necessities should be directed towards a higher purpose. The real oneg of Shabbos is when you sit back on Shabbos and you open up a sefer and you have a discussion and you learn Torah and you transform yourself and you're in a different world, a different universe. That's what keeping Shabbos is about. So the refraining is important, but only as a means to an end. Unfortunately for many people, and the reason why a lot of people have trouble with the mitzvos, is that they see them purely as negatives. They don't see the positive. See, the refraining, the removal of the freedom. Something which begins as lechem oni, if it is used properly, if they learn the ideas, they internalize the ideas, and they redirect their energies to a new type of an involvement, that becomes geula. That's why the matzah is the quintessential symbol of the geula. So at the end of the Seder, when you have realized the significance of all of these ideas, then you eat the matzah. And you eat the matzah because the matzah became the symbol of real freedom, expressed in how you live your life, and that the physical matzah is perfect. It means that you restrain yourself, that as soon as it's ready, as soon as it serves its purpose as food, you stop the process. You don't continue the process in order to enhance it and to give it taste and to give it to all of the luxuries. Matzah represents a life which is not the pursuit of luxury, but which recognizes that the physical is good only as a means to an end. But beyond that, when you have your needs and you're just pursuing luxuries which are purely in the imagination, the physical has no purpose at all. That's when a person is redeemed. So matzah is really the quintessential food of redemption. So on the basis of this exposition, I'd like to bring it all together and see if I can answer my questions. The question of Chayev Adam Liros Es Atzmo, that a person is obligated to see himself, to envision himself as though he himself went out of Egypt. Now, people have said that that's what it means. You have to like sort of imagine, create this fantasy in your mind. I disagree. It means to say that the telling of the story is personal. It has to result. It's not recounting a historical event, but you have to see it as something which pertains to you. This is your story. It's the story of your life. It has to emerge as something which is very, very personal. This is my story. This is my history. But the question arises, how does it become personal? What is the mechanism through which this becomes a personal story? And the answer to that question is that the essence and the very lifeblood of the Jewish people, of Jewish existence, is something called the Masorah. It's a very hard word to translate. Can anybody think of the Masorah is the system of transmission? That we are a Masorah community. The Jewish people is, I think the Rav coined this term, but I don't think I coined it myself. The whole lesson is that we're a Masorah community. That is to say that our greatest treasure, the body of ideas, that constitutes Judaism, the written law, the oral law, all of this is something which was given to us. We didn't create it ourselves. It was given to us. And we become Jewish by becoming a part of the Masorah community. And the Masorah community involves two things. To receive, we have to receive the Masorah, which means we have to study it and we have to understand it. But that's not enough. There's another component to being part of the Masorah community. What do you have to do after you receive it? You have to transmit it. This is the night of the Masorah. The night of Pesach was designated. This is the night when you fulfilled your obligations as a member of the Masorah community. So you're involved in studying, you're involved in learning, and the greatest minds, it tells you about all these great rabbis that gathered and stayed up all night long. Yeah, and you must be involved in transmission. That's why the child is there. Not because the child is obligated in mitzvos, but because when it comes to Masorah, that has nothing to do with the age of responsibility. That has to do with making him into a member of the Masorah community. And that is by the vehicle of transmission. And that's why I say, if you don't have a child, so you invite a friend, preferably an individual that doesn't know the story, so that you fulfill the mitzvah, not just of telling a story, but of presenting someone with the foundations of what Judaism is all about. And of course, what does it mean that if a person did not say these things, Pesach Matzah Maror, he did not fulfill his responsibility? What does that mean, he didn't fulfill his responsibility? It means to say that he didn't fulfill his responsibility of telling the story. That the telling of the story is not simply recounting the history that we were repressed and we were freed, but it has to, the whole essence is what the purpose was. The purpose of all of this was to give us, to establish a new religion which is based upon a completely different system, a system of mitzvos, which means to say that we have, I don't even like to use the word religion, I just have to use that word because everybody calls Judaism a religion. It's a religion of reason, a religion of rationality, a religion of ideas. That's why he has to demonstrate that through the mitzvah, to take the mitzvah and to explain the concept behind the mitzvah. That shows that every mitzvah that we have is based upon an idea, it's based upon a concept, and it's recognition that this is the purpose of everything that was done, not just to give us a false, this physical freedom, but to give us a system, a religious system, which truly liberates the soul and really brings us into a relationship with the HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the essence of the Sefer Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's what it means whoever did not say these three things. When you do the mitzvos on that night, you have to understand what you're doing, and you have to appreciate the significance of what this means in terms of what God did for us. And now the final question, tough question to answer. The first one that I mentioned, are we free or are we enslaved? Where are we? Where are we now? It means to say that, as the rabbis say, that before Sinai, there was really no such thing as free will. Because free will presupposes that a person has knowledge of the good. And as long as people don't have knowledge of the good, they cannot make a choice. They can't exercise choice. Once the Torah was given, so free will exists. And the situation we're in right now is unique, is significant. All of Israel has a share in the world to come. God gave us the opportunity to obtain freedom by adherence to the Torah. So therefore we're not really enslaved anymore in that sense. We're separated from the rest of the peoples. We're a very unique kind of nation. Let me just add one thing. I recently illustrated this idea. I was discussing the difference of the Jewish people, the uniqueness of Jewish existence, that we are not a nation like any other nation. That is to say, our identity is we're a special people that God chosen, and our mission is to transmit the true ideas that God has given us for ourselves and for all of mankind. I said it, and I'm just saying this purely in abstract, and you can disagree with me on this. It just occurred to me. They had the Olympics recently. They did have the Winter Olympics. There's a lot of controversy, but that's not what I'm referring to. And Israel sent a team to the Olympics. I just happened to notice, flick on the television, it's ice skating. And naturally, being a Jew, you know, you're always rooting for the Israelis. I am, anyway. Whenever I see a Jewish ball player on a team, you know, they didn't win. But I was thinking about it afterwards, from a strictly theoretical point of view. I'm not saying this in a practical way. I wouldn't participate in the Olympics. Because the whole notion of the Olympics is based upon this idea of nations getting together. But all of those nations share this idea. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that idea. That they're all there, you know, if a Frenchman feels that France, we're special, we're unique, we're different, a certain uniqueness, a certain collective ego, and the Americans, that's fine for the rest of the world. But for us to participate is to say that we're a nation just like you're a nation, and we're rooting for ourselves just like you're rooting for yourself. That's not the Jewish people. So I'm not saying in a practical way. I don't mean to say they did a bad thing. I don't think these thoughts even came up in anybody's mind. And I'm using it purely as a means of illustrating my point. that the Jewish people, that's why it's a nation which dwells apart. Dwells apart means it's not part of the family of nations, and never will be part of the family of nations, although that we know in a practical way, but that's not what I'm talking about. If you understand what the Jewish people really is, and what your identity as a Jew is, you realize that it has nothing to do with any other concept of nationalism. And the idea of the Haggadah is that Ashata Avda, that right now we are enslaved because God gave us the Torah. He gave us the derech to achieve true freedom, but we have to be moda, we have to acknowledge that we really haven't accessed the Torah. We haven't reached a state in which we appreciate the true ideas of Torah and to achieve the freedom of the Torah. So we keep the Torah and we observe it, and for many people it becomes a religion like any other religion. It's just a religious obligation. That's the effect. We're still affected by assimilation. We're still affected by foreign cultures, and to a tremendous extent we are affected by other religions. And that's really what exile is all about. Because many of the religious ideas that Jews have towards Judaism, if I look into them, you see that they're really influenced by non-Jewish religious ideas. So therefore, our entire mission is to reach a level where we truly access what Judaism is really all about. And we understand the profound philosophical concept, how Judaism is different. It's not just another religion. We have our practices, they have their practices, but this is founded upon the true foundations, the real recognition of the concept of the true creator, a being who is beyond the universe, who can't be depicted in any way, the obliteration of idolatry, and a system of performances which is rooted in enabling us to make contact, to reach the creator through appreciation of his wisdom, a system of ideas. That's the end of the first half. We give Hallel for that, because it's not a complete, even though it's not a complete freedom, it's the situation, the opportunity for freedom is there, and whoever is fortunate will access it. But the Jewish nation today is not the Jewish nation that was intended. It is not the kingdom of priests. It's not the Mamlachas Kohanim V'Gai Kadosh. It's not a beacon of light to all the other peoples. And that's why we pray the second half of the Haggadah is really the Geula Ha'asida, is the ultimate Geula. Next year we will be free means to say that we have to recognize the truth, that we have not achieved the true state of freedom. The true state of freedom where everybody will follow the Torah because they'll recognize that it's truly in line with their own nature, where you'll be free from this struggle, where you have, on the one hand, you have these desires and you have to overcome them because you have to be religious and you have to have guilt and you have to have fear. The ultimate result will be that all the Jews will recognize the great beauty of the Torah, the great freedom of the Torah, and that's the era of the Mashiach, where the entire world will be drawn towards the Jewish people, because they will realize that the Jewish people have the special wisdom which God granted to all of mankind. So that is the note on which we close the Haggadah. And these thoughts, these ideas are, as I said, extremely significant for us today, because as I mentioned at the very beginning, we've been sent a wake-up call. And I just want to reiterate that. We cannot go about life as usual. We thought the Holocaust was behind us. But many of the commentators have mentioned that in certain ways the situation today is worse than in the Holocaust, when they say that these Islamic terrorists have targeted Jews across the world. And this reporter, Daniel Pearl, at first we thought it was because he was a journalist and an American. That was part of it, but you know that his last words were, "I am a Jew, my mother is a Jew." His parents were Israelis. And the terrible brutality with which he was killed, so they can't even show the video, he was butchered in a horrible, horrible way, was not because he was a journalist and not because he was an American, it was because he was a Jew. And that type of venom exists, it's throughout the world, and most significantly, our thoughts and our prayers must be with Achenu, with our brothers in Eretz Yisrael, who once again are being targeted, innocent victims being targeted for destruction. And as yet, it doesn't seem like there's any type of a solution. And therefore, we are obligated, we have a chiyuv, we can't turn our backs on the situation, We just can't go on with life as usual and our ordinary pleasures and trips and luxuries. We have to recognize that the solution, there'll never be any solution, I've mentioned this many times, the ultimate solution of peace for the Jews cannot come about through the purely political. You learn this in the story of the Megillah. The Jews had to do tshuva, they had to return to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So let this be a stimulus for all of us to return in truth to a real appreciation of Torah, to tefillah, and to tzedakah, and to a love of our fellow Jews. And hopefully this is extremely important. Don't think that just because you're not there and you can't change the policies, don't think that every tefillah that you're involved in, don't think that any mitzvah you do does not have significance, because in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, these things have tremendous significance. So let us hope that as a result of this, we'll return to serving God with faithfulness. And this will be the herald of the Yeshua and a new Geula. I thank you. And I wanted to say, if you may, we could say Tehillim. It's very important that we say Tehillim, and then we'll daven Maariv afterwards. So please, if everybody will get a seer. And when you're mispiral, have in mind that you're being mispiral for the safety of the Jewish people.